Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and today we begin the program by focusing on mushrooms. Mushrooms are very nutritious. They're good for your health. They contain various vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants, and you know what? They're fun to grow, too. And we have a couple of guests with you to talk about mushroom growing. They are with Field and Forest Products, the company located in Peshtigo, Wisconsin. With us, Joe Krawczyk, co-owner of the company. Joe, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
Great to have you here. With us as well, it's mycologist, Lindsay Bender. And Lindsay, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks so much for the chance to be on.
As we talk with our two guests today, I hope you'll join in. Would you like to grow your own mushrooms? What questions do you have for our guests? You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Joe, let's start with you. Tell us how Field and Forest got started.
Well, Larry, that's a long and interesting story, so I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version. Way back when, in 1982, I was working for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on an acid rain program, and across my desk came a paper from the Forest Products Lab on cultivation of shiitake on natural logs, a potential new industry for the United States. Well, of course, I read that with interest, and it was predicting to be a $1 billion industry within a decade. Well, we're still waiting, but, you know, that's what got us interested in mushroom cultivation. And my wife and business partner, I decided, like, hey, let's hop on this. So we had resources in Peshtigo, and we decided just to move forward. And, you know, it's like anything else, you take a chance, and then it becomes a career. And here we are.
Yeah. Pretty cool story, actually. And Lindsay, what about you? How did you become interested in mycology?
So I was a graduate student at UW Green Bay, and I had really enjoyed a mix of biology-related classes, including microbiology and mycology, as well as ecology. So I found that mycology and the mushroom spawn business is kind of a wonderful mix of all of those. And at the time, my professor recommended this job posting. So fresh from college, I met Joe and Mary Ellen and visited Field and Forest Products. And here we are 10 years later.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. What's your favorite thing about mushrooms, Lindsay?
I would say the diversity, not only biologically speaking, but also the applications. In terms of cultivation, there's also so many different species that are cultivated and grown with different methods, different flavors. So every day there's something new, it seems.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Todd in La Crosse has a question about one type of mushroom. Let's go there. Hi, Todd.
Oh, hello. Hi. Yeah, and first off, thanks. I did come to your seminar maybe about 8 years ago on how to do the shiitakes, and we've done it every year, and it does work. and we try to do 25 or 50 logs every year. But my question is, I was thinking of branching off, and we have some walnut tree tops, and I've heard that the lion's mane can be grown with the drill and fill. Is that reliable, or is it a little more experimental?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question that we're asked every year, and every year we try to address it. But due to a lack of black walnut in this part of the state, we really haven't given any really rigorous testing. So we're really basing our recommendation on that on input from other customers who have access to black walnut. And I guess the verdict is, yeah, it works okay. You know, if you really want to grow lion's mane, there's other wood species that do better. And also, you can also be growing on a ready-to-food sawdust block. But that takes the fun out of it. You got the wood, when you got that desire to try something new and exciting, well, hey, I say go for it.
Yeah, there you go, Todd. Thanks for calling. And actually, I noticed on your website, which, by the way, is a really good website, that there's even a listing of trees that probably do the best, Lindsay, on depending on the type of mushroom.
Yes, that's definitely true. As Joe mentioned, we collect a lot of data on, you know, tree species and how suitable they are for the various mushroom species that we offer. And so we do our best to kind of put out that information that we've consolidated into a chart that kind of gauges suitability. And Joe mentioned, you know, we gather that information from growers, and one of the programs that we offer is citizen science, where essentially we work with growers wherever they're located, and they may or may not have access to tree species that we're able to test. And so oftentimes we'll work with them, send spawn, and then gather results and compile that into our database.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool database, actually. Joe, and your company's certified organic, and that apparently was important to you. Why was that?
Well, you know, it goes way back to the 1980s when we were asked by OCIA to write national standards for wood decay fungi, you know, that could be produced in a certified organic way. To me, it's the right thing to do. We believe in organic agriculture. We believe in the processes involved that maintain organic integrity. And, you know, the thing is that the way we produce shiitake, for instance, on natural logs, you really can't get much more organic than that. You know, we're harvesting a tree from a woodlot, or we're using a top from a timber harvest to grow an edible food product in a natural log. So in a way, it was kind of an easy step to take to go from conventional to organic. And we've always remained organic and will continue to do so because, as I said, it's really the right thing to do.
Yeah, is it difficult? I guess it doesn't sound like it would be difficult, but is it difficult to maintain an organic certification?
You know, like anything else, there's always hoops to jump through. But, you know, we've been doing it for so long, it's actually kind of second nature to us. We've really grown in the amount of fungi and different spawn that we offer to the consumer. And as a result of that, the hardest part has been sourcing certified organic stock for what we grow. But once you get that dialed in, it's just, you know, it's a phone call away now.
And Joe, maybe you could, well, continue that. You were kind of mentioned products. Maybe you can talk about the products that you do sell commercially and to, you know, the average person.
Sure. We sell numerous different types of mushroom spawn based upon what the person wants to grow. We've been involved with the production on shiitake and natural log since 1983, I do believe. So we offer that spawn, and that's our bread and butter. We offer it in the sawdust base, the plug base. And if you want to explore growing on a substrate, a grain-based spawn. But, you know, the interest in cultivation of other species and that knowledge that has become available to us has grown over the decades. So now we produce spawn for, and Lindsay, correct me, I lost track here, I think, at least 12 different strains of shiitake, at least 6 different oyster mushrooms. We grow spawn for the chestnut mushroom, namako, king oyster, maitake, silver shelf, and the list goes on and on and on.
Well, Lindsay, maybe you could talk about what you all do there. You're a video star, I see, too. I watched all your videos on your website, which were all interesting and fun. But what are your responsibilities?
Yeah. So I would say that, you know, not only do we provide the materials like the spawn Joe was discussing to growers, but a big part of our business model is to really educate you know, in the last few years. And, you know, since the 80s, we've really seen a growing interest in mushroom cultivation, especially in the last handful of years. And with that, you know, we get a lot of questions for people that are new to cultivation. So a big part of what we do is the education and testing new methods to ensure that they are commercially viable, or maybe they're more in the dabbling experimental realm. So apart from offering those supplies and materials for growing mushrooms, we also really delegate a lot of time towards training and education.
So that's part of the help that you can provide anybody who it probably is interested, but certainly who would be buying your products.
Yes, definitely. You know, one of the things that we often hear is that people will call us and they're really surprised that they get to talk to an actual human being. Really answer questions, no matter how long they want to stay on the phone. We'll be there to help them.
That is pretty cool. And Lindsay, I want to go back to those videos a little bit, because one of the part of the it was educational for me to watch all of the videos that you have produced. Maybe you could describe what you were doing there, and part of research to kind of substantiate the benefits, but done in a what I thought was a very as a professor here, scientific method.
Yeah, so perhaps you're referring to the SARE-funded work that we did where we investigated the additional benefits of cultivating wine cap, which it is not grown on logs such as shiitake, but it's rather grown on straw or wood chips, generally in a bed form, directly on the ground. And over the years, Joe and the other co-owner, Mary Ellen, had just noticed that in these areas where the wine cap was grown, the soil underneath, after just a year or two, seemed richer with better tilth and water holding capacity. And so over the years, this was an observation that they continuously noticed. And so part of that SARE-funded work was to actually set up a research project. And we did collaborate with a few other entities as well to make sure that we were getting the testing and the data we wanted to look at. But yeah, over the years, we found that wine cap significantly improved several parameters of soil health. And along with that, we also planted several crop plants, including black beans, tomatoes, corn, and other plants to kind of measure their health in response to the wine cap. And in most of those crops, we found that those plants that were polycultured alongside the mushroom wine cap, they yielded more, they were healthier, they were larger, more vigorous. So it was exciting for us because not only do we enjoy growing mushrooms and consuming them, but it was interesting to actually evaluate the additional benefits.
Yeah. And that wine cap composting material, that's actually available for people, is it not?
Yeah, so that's not something that we generally offer, although we do have a large amount of mushroom compost. But yeah, I've certainly seen in garden stores and you know, local offerings, this mushroom-based compost. And the thought is that, you know, some of those additional benefits and the antioxidants that come from mushrooms and all of that can be applied to your garden space, and you can gather some of those benefits.
We are talking today with a couple of folks from the Field and Forest Products Company. Joe Krawcheck is a co-owner, and the mycologist for the company, Lindsay Bender. Questions for them about mushrooms or growing them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. Talking today with co-owner of Field and Forest Products, Joe Krawcheck, and mycologist for the company, Lindsay Bender, and we're visiting about mushrooms today on the show. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Brian sent us an email. Are you any closer to being able to grow morel mushrooms?
Well, we were wondering when that question was going to pop up. Let me just give you our experience, and then I'll defer to Lindsay on this one. You know, we've been planting morel spawn on our property for decades. And you know what? And we get morels. But the question becomes, is that a result of the planting of mushroom spawn, or is it a change in the ecosystem that's allowing morels to show up that have already, that have always been there? So, you know, that's the million-dollar question. Is it working, or is it just a figment of our imagination? So, Lindsay, yeah, you got the latest greatest on all of this.
Yeah, so this has certainly been a mushroom that has been the eye of many cultivators in terms of, you know, a goal. And there's a long history of morel cultivation, including here in the U.S., but it was met with inconsistencies and complications. And then about 10 years ago, we started seeing significant signs of success out of China in terms of artificial cultivation of morels. And that was very promising. Since then, there's been a ton of development and really just understanding of the biology of these mysterious mushrooms. Morels are different than a lot of the standard cultivation mushrooms, which you provide a food source in ideal conditions and they just naturally fruit. The morel is more complicated than that, and that's why it's eluded many cultivators for so long. That being said, now with some more understanding, we've learned the importance of the actual mushroom strain itself and how capable it is for fruiting and cultivation. And then second, also, we've learned with some of that biology, there are conditions that are specific that are required, along with triggers for fruiting that can really help in promoting a successful fruiting. So the long story is that there's been a lot of headway in the last few years. And even success here, there's a Michigan researcher, Greg Bonito, that's been working on adapting that to North America. And, you know, we're working with new strains of mushrooms each year. And I think each year there's more and more promise to really nail it down.
Yeah.
I think Joe and I would concur that we'd still call it experimental, but I think we're getting really close.
Yeah. Well, hope you guys make it. You'll probably have an extra dollar or two in your bank account if you come up with us with a way to consistently grow morels. And they're so unusual. My dentist at the time, Bill, was telling me about one of his clients who said, oh, I've got all these mushrooms growing in my lawn in the backyard in my city street. Can you come over and take a look? And he said he went over and there were two grocery shopping bags full of morel mushrooms right in the middle of the darn lawn.
Yeah, how often we've heard that story, and it's pretty funny. We have people say, you know, I just got done mowing all those open.
Well, he said he couldn't wait for the next year, but the next year when the client came back, he asked her, she said, no, I don't have any of them this year. It's pretty unpredictable. Joe in Hayward has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I am looking to inoculate some freshly cut maple logs, and I was looking at the cold weather shiitakes for plug spawn, and I'm wondering what I can expect for yield and how many years.
All right.
Well, yeah, that's that is one of the most commonly asked questions that we get, and of course, it's going to boil down to what species of maple you're using, because hard maple is going to yield better than soft maple. And with cold weather strains, you know, you're going to start getting productivity in Hayward. Oh, it's going to take a good 15 months from the time of inoculation to fruiting. And then yields, there too, it's going to be based upon weather and management and how much love and attention you give your logs. But typically, with something like a cold weather strain, we look at a 10% yield of the wet weight of the wood. So if you got a 30-pound log, you're going to get 3 pounds of mushrooms over the life of that log. You know, there's different strains of shiitake, and the thing is that if you've never grown shiitake before, what I would say, take a look at a wide range strain. They're much easier growing. Typically, the yields are going to be a little bit better, and they're going to give you a faster response because, as we have found out over the decades, this crop takes patience, and a lot of people don't have that. And I would say, you know, if you're the type A personality that needs results now, please grow radishes and leave the mushrooms to other people.
Okay. Joe, there you go. And by the way, the size I saw on your somewhere on your website, the size of the diameter of the log, whatever it is, has an effect on like how long it's going to last and yield. Right, Lindsay?
Yeah. So overall, you can use all sorts of log sizes, but we find the ideal range is really 4 to 6 inches and about 36 inches to 40 inches long or so. That's kind of the standard. Usually at that size, they're easy to handle. They colonize rapidly. When you get into those larger diameter logs, like 8 to 10 inches, those get a lot heavier and harder to handle. But there is, of course, more substrate, more wood there. And you know, those larger logs can certainly produce more, but they will take quite a bit longer to get established before you get those first mushrooms. So that's always something to keep in mind.
Yeah. Joe, thanks much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Barb in Milwaukee. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I purchased some wine cap one from you guys a couple years ago, probably 4 years ago. And they did fine the first year. I put some around vegetables in my garden and some under a cherry tree. And but they, after the first year, I never saw them again. So I just wondered, are they a variety that you must purchase the one every year, or did I do something wrong?
Well, if you got mushrooms, evidently you did something right, which is great. Now, with wine cap, that's going to yield in longevity of the bed are going to be based upon the substrate and the substrate thickness. So, for instance, I remember feeling a call from someone who they said 3 years to produce a mushroom crop, but their substrate bed was 15 inches deep. And that bed, of course, lasted for years and years and years. So the thing is with wine cap, eventually it will take all that organic matter, all that substrate, and turn it into organic matter. So typically, yeah, we say, you know, give it a year, give it two, and then you'll probably want to start a new bed because it isn't what we'd say is a long-lasting perennial. It's kind of just a 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 year affair before it's pretty well run through its food source.
Would there be a better spawn for Barb to use?
You know, in the urban setting, or even in a rural setting, wine cap is a great mushroom for decaying readily available substrates such as wood chips and straw. You can go to growing other mushrooms, like almond agaricus or the bluet, but those aren't as easy. And the yields aren't nearly as good, but they certainly are, of course, a challenge to the gardener to grow and add, once again, another point of interest in the garden.
Yeah. Barb, does that help out?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Jim in Burnham Wood. Hi, Jim.
Hi. This is Uncle Jim in Burnham Wood. I've been working with you folks for at least 20 years. But what I really wanted to comment on is the fact that every year when I get my emails from you, you're always coming out with something new. And this last year, you came out with growing your own or making your own blocks for shiitake. And they're great during the winter months. They have something to grow. I had the 8-block set and the whole kit. And I guess what I was really doing is kind of commenting on how well it did. I don't know how much feedback you've been getting. I've grown the shiitakes in the blocks that you buy as a separate block, and now I've grown made the blocks from the kits that you have, and I would say I get about half as much shiitakes off of that as I would from one of your pre-made blocks. Some people, and we've got a wine club, and there were several people that have been doing this for several years who have gone through and done this, and some of them have had better luck, and some of them have less luck. I actually had two blocks, and the first block I wasn't real impressed with. The second block did a lot better. And it's probably just my technique of putting the blocks together that probably had something to do with it. But in any case, it was a wonderful experiment, and now I'm doing the second one, which was with the hen of the woods. And they're sitting there in my fermentation chamber, again from the wine club, sitting there getting nicely set up for putting them in the ground in June. So that's my feedback. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Well, I'll get some comments.
Thanks for the positive feedback, but also bear in mind that we're always welcome of negative feedback too, because, hey, we got to know how we're doing. Once that product leaves the door, we put it into the grower's hand, and we hope for the best. The best possible product out there, and hopefully they'll get the best possible results.
Let's talk about the grow kits for a bit. You've got... obviously, there's differences when growing inside versus outside, Lindsay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And some growers don't have access to land or space or maybe freshly cut wood. So there are a lot of ways to grow various mushrooms, and indoor cultivation is really appealing, especially for those of us in the north with these long winters. It's a nice way to cultivate food inside or even throughout the year. So with these kit options, essentially you're growing mushrooms on like a sawdust-based substrate instead of wood chips or straw. And that makes it very adaptable. Oftentimes those mushroom blocks fruit a lot faster than waiting up to a year before you get your first mushrooms on an oak log. The caveat to that is that oftentimes those blocks only fruit for several weeks to maybe 2 months. So it's a faster but shorter term payoff there. But the good news is that a lot of varieties are very adaptable to that method. And furthermore, with the availability of hardwood fuel pellets, which are essentially pre-sterilized, that allows growers to even make their own blocks, which is what I believe the caller was referring to. So that's kind of a low-tech method to really getting hands-on and getting more part of that process as opposed to just purchasing a kit that's been prepared by someone like us.
And what's included in a typical kit? Well, you know, I order one when it comes in the mail. What do I get?
Yeah, so if you're doing a ready-to-fruit block, that may be something that we've fully prepared. When you receive it, you simply open it up and the mushrooms do their thing. They fruit as soon as 6 days to 21 days, depending on the variety. With some of the kits, it's going to be a little more hands-on, where you're actually adding the water and mixing the substrate and then inoculating or adding that mushroom spawn to the material you've prepared. So we have a suite of kits available depending on whether you want to simply open it up and wait or you want to get a little more hands-on. That's probably going to be that hardwood fuel pellet kit. And with that, everything is sent along. You have all the materials you need apart from the water.
And now this is an aside, but it's something I saw on your website, and I thought, what is this? And it had to do with the use of cheese wax in organic production. And I thought, well, cheese wax. So I said, I got to ask that question. So what the heck is cheese wax, Joe, and how's it used?
Well, here we are in the dairy state, and we're blessed with an abundance of cheese wax producers, believe it or not. Cheese wax is used as a sealant for preventing spawn from drying out with natural log cultivation. So what happens is you're putting spawn into a log, and that spawn in our climate will tend to dry. So what we do is we heat up a bunch of cheese wax and we daub it on to seal that spawn into the log to maintain the moisture in the spawn.
Thank you for answering that question, because it's been in the back of my mind ever since I saw it. But that makes perfect sense to me. And there's no shortage of cheese wax in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, we're fortunate. We have two suppliers. And, you know, the thing is, it's our never-ending trial with organics and wax. But we do have a clear cheese wax that's been approved for organic production.
So the sounds like with a kit, you can either have mushrooms pretty darn fast, or maybe it's going to take a little while, Lindsay.
Yes, and that variation depends on the type of kit, but also the biology of the mushrooms. We have oyster mushrooms, which are incredibly vigorous. They grow really quickly. They're highly adaptable. They also have these broad fruiting temperature ranges, so they can be grown on a lot of different products, different substrates, and very quickly. So with oysters, oftentimes you're waiting a matter of days before those mushrooms begin to form. And once those mushrooms form, they form quickly over the period of sometimes 24 to 72 hours. On the flip side, there are some different mushroom varieties like the chestnut that tends to fruit slower. It's not necessarily less vigorous, but less aggressive, and it takes a little more time to prepare to fruit. And, you know, when mushrooms are cultivated or grown under cooler conditions, they tend to fruit or grow a little slower. And so sometimes those varieties can take up to 3 or 4 weeks before they're ready for harvest. It just kind of depends back to that biology of the mushroom itself and then how we're actually growing it.
I remember growing mushrooms once at home, and this is a long time ago, but I was circumstances led me out of the house for a week or better, and so the moisture level, it dried up quite a bit on me. So how much... And I did get some mushrooms, but not what I certainly would have expected had I been watering. How much care does it take?
Well, that's, of course, going to be dependent upon which mushroom you're growing and where. For instance, with shiitake logs outside, typically we have enough rainfall to carry log moisture content through the growing season. But then again, we run into really dry times when a little bit of help with irrigation goes a long way in getting the fungus established in the log. Now, conversely, what we see with some other mushroom crops, such as wine cap, which is, of course, grown in a bed on the ground, people will tend to love that to death. And they'll do that by overwatering. So it's, once again, it's that fine line between an art and a science with mushroom cultivation with moisture control. And, you know, believe it or not, mushrooms have survived without human help for a long time. But, you know, a little bit of help with a little bit of irrigation every once in a while goes a long way.
How many mushrooms, I mean, do we even have an idea of how many mushrooms, types of mushrooms exist in the world?
Do you want to take a stab at that, Lindsay? Because I have no idea.
Gosh, in terms of species of fungi, it's a huge and diverse kingdom. So millions, I would guess. In terms of mushrooms and then further cultivated mushrooms, there are quite a few less. You're probably talking, you know, maybe 30 or 40 established cultivars, and that's generally they're all contained within a specific group of fungi in general called Basidiomycota, and those tend to be a little easier to cultivate, many of which are obviously edible, but beyond that, many, many species of fungi.
Grant sent us an email. He has a friend in the San Francisco Bay Area who sends him porcini mushrooms that he foraged and then dried. Grant has never seen any sold fresh in Madison area farmers markets. Are they found only in the wild and in certain areas of the U.S.? He'd love to find some porcinis fresh.
Well, porcinis are found here in the state of Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, typically the latter part of August in oak forests. My Polish heritage takes me out to look for them. And you know what? I often come back with an empty basket because even though I'm out there to hunt, that doesn't mean the mushrooms are going to be ready. Now, it's interesting to note, recently there's been some research done on cultivation of that species. And that's happening in Europe where they're looking at, once again, forming a root association with specific trees to grow porcini, much like what has been done with the truffle fungus. So hold on. We'll see what happens.
And Tom emailed to ask how long it takes to grow mushroom spawn on wood log versus one of your mushroom blocks. Is there a growth life difference? How about it? And wondering about flavor and richness of flavor, Lindsay.
Yeah, so with log cultivation, there is this extended period of establishment. Essentially, to inoculate or plant a log, you're drilling holes across the surface area of that log and adding spawn, sealing with that cheese wax there. And then there's this waiting period where the mycelium in that spawn needs to colonize the majority of that log before it's able to fruit mushrooms. And that time it takes depends on the mushroom variety, the size of the log, and a few other factors. But in general, you know, hardwood logs are difficult to colonize, and that wait period can be a year to a year and a half, depending on the variety. Now, some mushrooms like oyster prefer softer hardwoods like box elder, which is a softer hardwood, easier to colonize. And then the wait time with some of those can be as short as 4 months after inoculation. When you get into producing mushrooms on other substrates like straw or wood chips or sawdust-based materials, oftentimes that wait time or establishment time is much shorter, on the period of weeks to perhaps months, depending on the variety, in which case you're able to harvest mushrooms as soon as a month after planting.
Talking today with two representatives from the Field and Forest Products Company of Peshtigo, Wisconsin, one of the co-owners, Joe Krawcheck, and mycologist Lindsay Bender. Questions for them, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you with us today, and a big thanks to everyone who donated during our one-day winter member drive. Support from people like, well, Heidi and Nina, Margaret and Appleton, and others, of course, makes WPR's essential service possible. If you missed the member drive, still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. You certainly play an important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. And thank you so much for your partnership. We really appreciate it. As here on Garden Talk, we take a look at mushrooms. And just to let you know, coming up in the second hour of the show today, we'll be getting some advice on adding food plants to your landscaping. So looking forward to that as well. Right now, we're talking mushrooms with a couple of folks from the Field and Forest Products Company of Peshtigo, Joe Krawcheck, who is a co-owner, and mycologist Lindsay Bender. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Maybe we could talk about some of the terminology that you use. You know, when I saw the spawn, that word come up first, I thought of immediately to Star Trek. There were a few shows that related to the spawn, which are not the spawn you are talking about. There's some cool terminology. Maybe you can talk about some of it. So spawn first and then others.
Well, Linz, go ahead. You got a good grasp on it, so shoot.
Yeah, so I should apologize because I generally start any talk or educational event by describing what spawn is, because we use that word a lot. But in mushroom cultivation, I'm not so sure about Star Trek, but in mushroom cultivation, spawn is essentially a word for the seed or the carrier material of the mushroom mycelium. And I guess that's another term that I'll go ahead and describe. So mushrooms are the fruiting body, or the fruit, the structure that we're familiar with. That's the edible portion that people harvest when they're walking in the woods or from their shiitake log. But down below in the substrate or the media, the material that you're growing on, there's these fine root-like structures, the branching network of mycelium that kind of spreads and invades that substrate, harvests those nutrients. And that mycelium is generally what is used to inoculate or plant the material, the substrate you want to grow on. And so spawn can come in many forms depending on the usage or the material you want to plant. What's common for log cultivation is either a sawdust-based spawn or a plug spawn, which is essentially just a wooden dowel covered in that mushroom mycelium. And that wooden dowel then can easily be hammered into holes of an oak log. When it comes to other substrates, like inoculating straw with oysters, oftentimes people will utilize a grain-based spawn because it's easy to handle, and then the grains themselves can add nutrition and hopefully boost yields as well. So yeah, what Field and Forest Products does is produce spawn, and it comes in many different varieties depending on what you're looking to do with it.
And how's the company? I mean, you've been going a long time, Chuck. So obviously you've been successful. Would you say you work more with commercial operations, or do you work more with just the homeowners?
Well, we work, I would say, equally with both. We have a great community of home growers and small commercial growers that we service. And we also service large commercial growers nationwide. So we have a really large, wonderful family of customers that are growing mushrooms just about in every state in the union here. What keeps us going is that there's always something new and innovative coming up. You know, morel cultivation, you know, we've been pounding on that door for quite a while for success. And recently, we have started exploring in the cultivation of truffles here in the upper Midwest. So that's something new and exciting coming down the pipe. And boy, it's another project that's going to take time, but that's what fungi are all about, time. It takes time to rot things. It takes time to form fruit bodies. So, you know, we're patient people here.
So, thinking about truffles, and that reminds, you know, if you could grow truffles, truffles are, what, the most expensive if you were going to go try and buy them?
Well, yeah. Currently, I think the most expensive food product on the planet now is the Italian white truffle. And I'm not even going to quote a price because it's well out of my price range. Recently, we were at the Oregon Truffle Festival, and they saw me coming because I bought a black truffle at half a retail cost, and that was $35 an ounce. So for one mushroom, it was $70. Boy, the flavor and the uses of it, unbelievable. well worth the price of admission.
Well, that reminds me, how much do the mushrooms differ in taste? I remind me again, how many that you guys grow, and then what's the difference in taste among them, in flavor, I should say?
Well, let me just say that there's a world of difference between flavors and textures. You know, I cut my teeth on shiitake, and to me, that still is the most flavorful mushroom with so many culinary uses that it's unsurpassed. But then again, we can take a look at something like the Italian oyster. The Italian oyster is really good sautéed. As a matter of fact, we typically sauté it up for other dishes, and its nutty flavor prevents it from getting into those other dishes because we'll like eat them right out of the pan. Things like maitake, very woodsy, but with a great crunch that's just, that will hold up to any cooking technique. So, Linz, what do you got? What do you like in terms of fungi?
Yeah, so of all the varieties, there are so many different flavor profiles, and we get this question a lot when we sell fresh mushrooms at the Green Bay Farmers Market because they look different than that white button that people are used to. You know, when it comes to the white button, people that are comfortable and enjoy eating mushrooms, they know what to do with that one. But when you see a till of golden oysters or, you know, king oysters, where one mushroom can be well over a pound, you almost don't know what to do with it. So a big part of what we do is talk about flavor. And, you know, for some of the oyster mushrooms, they tend to be fairly mild and meaty. And so they can be incorporated in all sorts of ways, but they also don't hold a very overly strong flavor. As Joe mentioned with shiitake and some of the other varieties, they have such a distinct, unique flavor. With the shiitake, it's going to be bold and garlicky. With the hen of the woods or the maitake, it's going to be that true earthy, mushroomy sort of flavor. And so depending on what people are looking for or how brave perhaps they are, you know, we have a recommendation. But oftentimes people will walk up and say, okay, we're making pasta tonight. What do you recommend? So it just depends.
And you do, if I'm not mistaken, and I didn't look extensively at them, but you do have some recipes up, don't you?
Yeah, that's a big way that we can kind of convince people to give it a try, is at least show them a few options and what to do with it and how to prepare those mushrooms for cooking.
Yeah. So what are you having? What's your next meal of mushrooms?
Well, we were trying to coordinate a taco day at work. We like to do food days, and one of the easiest things to do is roast up some oyster mushrooms with a little bit of olive oil and taco seasoning and roast them until they're nice and meaty and use that as a meat substitute. So I guess that's my answer, but that's next week sometime.
And Joe?
Well, you know, we flavored some cheese with the truffles that we got in Oregon. So I think for lunch today, I'm going to try some truffle-enhanced Munster cheese on a sandwich.
Ooh. Oh, you're making me hungry, both of you. And people have just go online, I'm assuming, Joe, to if they want to order from you guys.
Sure. You know, definitely you can order anything you want online. But however, you know, if you have specific questions or you really are confused at what to do, give us a call. You know, we're always willing to help and guide people in their choice of mushroom spawn and the growing thing.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, Joe and Lindsay. I want to thank you both so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun learning about your work with mushrooms, and I bet you get a few clicks on your website today. Field and Forest Products is the name of the company. They're out of Peshtigo, Wisconsin. It's great to have them with us today. Coming up, we're going to talk about edible landscaping with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You, my friends, are listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And next on the show, we're going to take a look at edible landscaping. And our guest is Rachel Belinda, founder of Daily Harvest Designs out of Madison. She's an experienced landscape designer and permaculture consultant. Rachel has a degree in horticulture and landscape design, has completed a permaculture design consultants course and herbalism and ecosystems apprenticeship program. So she's got a lot of background here. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Have you added food plants to your landscape? What have you enjoyed about having food in your garden? What questions do you have about adding food plants? You can become part of the conversation right now, as a matter of fact. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Rachel Belinda, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's great to be here.
You know, I took a look at your story, your background, and I thought, good grief, we could probably spend the whole hour talking about that. But tell us, you have a very interesting story about how you became interested in plants and garden design, and eventually your current business, Daily Harvest Designs. Tell us about your journey.
Well, I didn't grow up gardening, and it wasn't until I was in high school that I became interested in plants, and it was just by chance. I took a horticulture-based biology class in high school, and my teacher was great, and I just got really interested in plants. So after that, I decided to study horticulture and landscape design, so I went off to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. And I really love the design aspect of it. So that's what I decided to get kind of my emphasis in. And after that, I started a small company in Minneapolis, which was really fun. I did garden design, installation, and maintenance. But after a few years, I was kind of like wondering if there was more I could do. I mean, I really loved the gardening work, but I wanted to make a difference in the world. So I started thinking about food plants and just wondering if I could swap out some of those ornamental trees and shrubs with fruiting bushes and fruit trees. And I had no idea about growing food plants at all. So I thought about that quite a bit, but then I also had this dream of joining the Peace Corps. So
off to the Peace Corps.
Off to the Peace Corps I went.
But that gave you some good, I mean, you learned a lot in that as well.
Yes, I did. It was a break from gardening, but I learned a lot of really good life lessons. And I just think it's so beneficial for anyone to get out of the country and see something completely different and experience a different kind of lifestyle. But when I was in the Peace Corps, I happened to find a book about permaculture design. So I read that book while I was, hanging out in my little mud brick house and decided I wanted to study that some more when I got home. So that's what I did. I moved to Portland, Oregon. And I lived there for about 8.5 years, and I studied permaculture design and herbal medicine, and I started my current business in 2012 when I was still in Portland.
And here you are now in Madison.
Here I am now, back in my home state of Wisconsin. I've been here about 8 years or so.
Yeah, actually, you're living in Mount Horeb, but
yep.
I'm sure you deal with people from all over this area, at least.
Yes, yep. I work locally and virtually for designs. For design work.
So what's your definition of edible landscaping?
Let's see. For me, it's a combination of like growing food in a really beautiful and functional way. So kind of taking those ornamental landscape design principles that I learned in college and combining them with the permaculture principles that I learned in the permaculture class I took, and creating a really beautiful and functional landscape where you can grow food and medicine.
It's really pretty cool. And maybe expanding on that through your business and what do you do with Daily Harvest Designs?
Yep. So when I first started with Daily Harvest Designs, I was just offering landscape design consultations and design services. So I still do that now, both locally and virtually. So I'll work with clients in all different states. But I'm also starting to create different products for people to download from my website. So it's kind of a lower price point and maybe more specific to just certain areas of a project. And I also, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I have a workshop coming up and... yeah.
Is that an online or is that an in-person?
No, that's an in-person.
That's an in-person
yeah.
one. Well, part of your mission is to seek solutions that require the least change for the greatest effect is what I think I remember reading. Could you expand on that?
That's one of the big permaculture ideas is to try to just work with the environment and the landscape as it is and make the most out of that. So rather than making large changes and completely restructuring the landscape, I like to look at what's happening already. Like, where is the water flowing in the property? How can we maximize that and use that to our benefit in the landscape? And then, you know, with that, I would play off of the water flow to create the design for the flow and function of the space, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And let's talk more about permaculture, because probably everybody listening or a lot of people listening will have some idea about permaculture itself. But it's certainly becoming popular as a concept. But again, talk more about what it means to you.
Let's see what it means to me. It's like a whole system design, basically. So permaculture doesn't have to just apply to gardens. It can apply to anything, like the way you arrange your home or your business. But it's basically taking a look at the bigger picture and figuring out how all the pieces can work together in a way that's going to function most efficiently and in a way that it will support all the pieces.
And, you know, when you're talking about supporting all the pieces, I was online looking at different areas where permaculture is applied, seems to be applied pretty much all over the world. I even noticed in Egypt, they took a desert area and made a permaculture out of a piece of the desert, and we're having really good success with it.
That's great.
Yeah, it's so there's a lot about it that I think is really intriguing. And when you're talking about edible plants in that landscape, what are the primary ones that you're typically dealing with clients, folks who might be listening today?
I deal a lot with like fruit trees and berry bushes. So basically bringing in the perennial food sources. So I'm looking less at the annual gardens, which the annual vegetable gardens are great, and that's definitely a part of it. But ideally, if we can bring in more perennial-based foods that are going to come back year after year, that's a really easy food source, right? Because you don't have to do too much for it. Plus, then you can build structure into your landscape and your garden. So you get the layered garden look like you would in an ornamental garden. Just, you know, you've got your trees and your shrubs, and it's not just a blank space that where there's nothing happening in the winter. You get seasonal interest as well.
Yeah. And it's, well, it's not a forest setting, but it's certainly a much more varied setting in terms of height and width and everything else.
Yep, exactly. And a lot of those edible plants are just really beautiful. So you can use them as like focal plants in a landscape, and they can really function as a lot of the ornamental plants would, but you're also getting that benefit of food in your garden as well.
Yeah, and they smell pretty good in the spring, too, when the flowers...
Yes.
So you're getting all of the senses. Well, let's take a call. Andy and Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Andy. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. When I moved in my house, it had, like, natural prairie landscaping in front, and I really couldn't tell the difference between the prairie grasses and weeds, and wound up pulling a lot of them out. So there was a very kind of enclosed area by the driveway in concrete where I planted mints. And then in the other areas, I planted chives, garlic chives, and bell flowers, which is like a Korean delicacy. And those are all thriving. And the garlic chives are pretty much taking over my lawn now. So whenever I mow the grass, it smells like onions.
Andy, thanks for calling. Rachel, you want to comment on Andy?
Yeah, it sounds like you picked great plants for that spot so they can grow wild and be happy but not spread too much, you know, aside from the garlic chives.
Yeah, well, aside from the garlic, and he did put the mint in an enclosed area,
yes.
Which is probably pretty. So would any of those be part of any landscaping that you would be doing?
Yes, for sure. And that would be, you know, like the ground level plants. So like when I work with clients and figure out the structure and the flow and the function of the landscape, I start with the shapes and then the trees and the shrubs. And then, of course, like all those smaller plants get filled in to the landscape as well.
Rachel Belinda, our guest today, founder of Daily Harvest Designs. And if you'd like to join in, maybe you have a question. Maybe it just relates to a particular fruit tree that you have or other plant that's in the edible area. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk here on WPR News, taking a look at edible landscapes today with our guest Rachel Belinda. I mispronounced your name. Sorry for that.
That's okay. It happens all the time.
Rachel Belinda is founder of Daily Harvest Designs. She's an experienced landscape designer and permaculture consultant and works a lot in edible landscapes. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. What are your thoughts on soil amendments? You go to somebody's place and you're looking at the soil and examining it or whatever. Do you often get involved in amending soil that's already there?
Sort of. It seems like a lot of my clients are starting with lawn as their base.
Okay.
So the question is, like, what do we do? How do we get rid of this lawn? So what I often like to encourage people to do is sheet mulch. So you basically lay down cardboard, a couple layers of cardboard, make sure to take off all the tape and the staples and things like that, and then pile on organic matter on top of that. And then that's going to smother the grass, and it's going to create a really awesome soil over time. So that's typically what I would just recommend, you know, to start with a nice base like that. Otherwise, compost is fantastic, and that's always my go-to, and make sure to keep your soil mulched.
Andrea in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Oh, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to recommend that people check out currants for their edible landscaping. There's no brighter shade of red than the red currant berries, and they produce in partial shade, which is really nice. And also, don't forget about our native currants. There's a clove currant, and the reason why it's called clove currant is that the flowers, which are yellow and are produced in the spring, very, very early, smell delightfully of cloves and cinnamon. It's really, really nice. They produce dark berries later in the summer, unlike the European black currants, they're not foxy. You can eat them right out of hand. So those are two of my faves.
Hey, Andrea, thanks so much. Well, comment on Rachel on what Andrea is suggesting.
Yes, currants are fantastic. I often recommend currants for clients as well. They're a really nice landscape plant. So they look good. They produce really well. And you can also get white and pink producing currants as well. So, and they all have very different flavors. They're great for jams and jellies. Sometimes I like to turn the berries into juice and make candies for my kids or fruit leather or jelly. But yeah, the plants themselves are great, and they tend to kind of like layer. So, you know, a branch will come down and it will reroot in the soil. So if you have a slope or a place with some erosion, that can be a good choice as well.
Sounds good. And those flowers that Andrea were mentioning would come really early in the spring, which is also a good thing for our pollinators.
Yep, definitely.
There's not a lot of early flowering in the spring.
Yep.
In Madison or pretty much any place else in Wisconsin, I think.
Yep.
And native plants, do you use a lot of natives? And if so, what native plants might you use in your work with homeowners?
Yeah, I do use native plants, and typically I use those in places where we don't want to grow food or can't grow food for some reason, like along the streets, kind of in the boulevard areas, or rain gardens, or places where there's a lot of traffic and dogs walking by. That's always great for native plants. And then any of the flowering natives are fantastic. The coneflowers and asters, grasses, you name it.
Yeah, I was thinking about my own, between the sidewalk and the street area, that's yep. exactly what I have in front of my home.
Yep, that's a great solution for that place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Christina. Again, Andrea, thank you very much for your comments. Christina in Glenwood City will give you a chance. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you. Your guest mentioned medicinal plantings, and I'm hoping she can expand on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, a lot of the plants that you might already have in your garden are medicinal. So if you're growing elderberries, for example, that's a really well-known medicinal plant. There's also plants like yarrow, which can be great for reducing fevers and stopping bleeding for cuts. There's weeds that are medicinal, like dandelions and plantain.
What do dandelions do?
They can be really helpful for your kidneys and liver, depending on which part you use.
Oh, so you can use the leaves or the flower itself?
Yep, or the root. Yeah, you can make a tincture out of the root. You can eat the leaves. You can make some dandelion flower fritters, which are fantastic. So when the dandelion flowers are wide open, you can batter them and fry them, and they're such a treat. We eat them every year.
Oh, what do you use for batter? This is off the top, yeah. topic a little bit, but
I think it's all related. My digestive system likes gluten-free, so I do like a gluten-free one-to-one type flour and eggs and milk, I want to say. It's, you know, been almost a year since I made them, so.
Christina, there you go. Thank you very much. So this is something you point out to clients as you're dealing with them?
Yep. Yeah. And some clients, they really want a medicinal garden. There was a woman who I worked with in Virginia, and she wanted a huge medicinal garden. So I helped her find places for a wide variety of medicinal plants in her garden. And I have a client in Madison right now, and that's their focus as well. So a lot of their garden is going to be medicinal plants, yeah, as well as food growing as well.
So Christina or somebody like her, you definitely sounds like you could help them out in that area.
Yeah, for sure.
Rosemary from Lodi called to ask for some edible perennials that deer might leave alone.
Oh, that's always such a tough one. I should get a good list on my website. The deer issue. I don't know if I can tell you off the top of my head what they will leave alone. I know that I just tend to plant more than I need. And anything that you don't want the deer to eat, maybe keep closer to your house. And then, of course, if you can fence off some areas, that's helpful as well.
I remember looking at another email. Could you give an example of a challenging place that you worked on and kind of the result or what you did? An example. You don't have to name where you were, but you can
Let's see. Well, challenging in what way? Because there are
all
sorts of
different
challenges.
There's a lot of different ways. So pick your own challenge and go from there.
Let's see. Can I think on that and come back to it?
you sure can. I'm going to make you come back
to
it.
Yes, that's fine.
What ideas do you have for people who want to replace some of that lawn? Where do they start?
Definitely start closer to your house if you're looking to grow food plants. Because, I mean, if you have your food close to your house where you see it and you walk past it, you're going to be more likely to harvest it and notice what's going on with it. So that's a good place. If you already have some garden beds, you can expand on those. So perhaps your ornamental landscape becomes kind of the backdrop for your edible landscape. So you can just widen your beds by taking out some of that grass and shifting your bed lines and start growing some edible and medicinal plants in front of those, if that makes sense.
What do we need to know about growing food in pots? Do you incorporate that sort of thing into your design work?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. People like to grow food in all different places, and you know, some people don't have a lot of in-ground space. So pots are great, but just make sure to keep them watered well. I would say look into an automatic watering system. At least for me, I know that's been helpful, because if I'm going to forget anything, it's my pots, and they really need that attention.
What planting mediums do you recommend, typically?
I just do like a organic blend with compost mixed in.
Yeah, so you're not going to use, you typically don't use commercial fertilizer then.
Correct.
Yeah.
I just go for anything organic if I'm going to be growing food.
And what about raised beds? They're certainly another great way to add food plants, I know. Mm-hmm. How do you use them in landscape design?
They fit into the bigger landscape. Let's see, how to describe it without being able to draw something. you have your like trees, fruit trees and berry bushes and, you know, ideally some nice flowing bed lines, but then you can also have your raised beds. So depending on the space, it can be its own separate area, or you can kind of mix it in with the rest.
So
that's not very specific, but...
fruit trees have come up pretty often, pretty traditional elements in gardens. What are some of your favorite varieties that you like to recommend?
Ooh, I love the contender peach tree. It's so good. We've had huge harvests of peaches at our house with no pests or disease issues at all on just a really small peach tree that's maybe 6 to 8 feet tall. 8 to 10 feet wide. That's done really well.
And what's the name again? Because people are going to say, which one did she say?
Contender.
Contender.
Yes. And then the Reliance peach is also a cold hardy peach tree.
And the Reliance.
Reliance, yep.
So those are two you recommend. Karen in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. First of all, I have to say that my nephews and nieces call me Eeyore, so my comment is about I've heard talk about bellflowers, mustard, dandelions. How do you keep control of that so that your neighbors aren't unhappy? Because like one of my neighbors, quote unquote, planted bellflowers and then threw a pile of them across the street on the terrace, which is for plantings, and that's taken over, and it's really hard to get rid of. As a matter of fact, I just don't know how. But in any case, some things are invasive, like garlic mustard, and, you know, yeah, it's not lawn, but, you know, your neighbors won't be too happy if you have. So that's all.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Karen. So what about that?
Yes, very good point. There are certain things that I wouldn't go out of my way to plant, like the invasive type things. Bellflower is really hard to get rid of. So I would say just if you have it already, harvest it. Try to catch things before they go to seed, or bellflower will spread underground. So that's a tricky one.
Yeah, that's a tough one without chemicals if you want to. Do you use many chemicals yourself in work?
No. Nope, I don't use any myself.
Okay, so when you're working with somebody, it's going to be an organic, quote-unquote organic kind of an approach.
Yes, ideally.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, diseases and pests can wreck a fruit crop pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with disease pests?
I mostly just plant more than I need, at least in my home garden. So, you know, every year is different. And some years I'll have a huge crop of peaches and some years huge crop of apples. And I just kind of go with the flow and just know that, you know, sometimes things aren't going to produce well and maybe something won't make it. So I'm kind of a tough love gardener.
David in Shorewood emailed to ask for recommendations for edible plants that can work in the shade.
Mm-hmm.
Violets grow pretty well in that area right now. It's between two apartment buildings.
Okay, yeah, violets are fantastic. Stinging nettle, which is another one that people may or may not want to plant, but that's a fantastic shade-loving plant that's edible. I have some black cap raspberries growing in the shade, another kind of weedy wild one. Let's see.
Good example there. And the virtual part of this, Jill wonders, virtual garden coaching you do.
Mm-hmm.
What can we find out virtually and what limitations are there to that type of a coaching session?
Yeah, there's a lot that we can do virtually, especially with just the technology and being able to get a pretty decent overview online from like Google Earth Pro. And then just with photos and video walkthroughs and talking to people, I'm able to help them quite a bit come up with either, you know, a full design if that's what someone wants, or for the coaching just to help answer questions or figure out, you know, how to reshape a bed and make your whole space flow together more, things like that.
So I suppose in a virtual, somebody could have photos or just take their computer outside, just point the camera
exactly
at a particular area. Do you do quite a bit of that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that sort of help exists. And I went on your website, and it's a pretty website, and you have a number of downloads.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what you've got for downloads.
Well, I have a few free downloads. So if you're just looking for some info, honestly, I'm trying to remember what's up there right now. I think there's like a fruit tree or there's a plant list kind of download. So I have those. I have some designs that are kind of ready to go. And I'm coming up with some plant palettes, which are like collections of plants that will grow well together in specific areas with different themes. So that's in the works. I have a DIY design workbook. So if you're looking to do your own design, it walks you through. It's pretty basic, but it's fun. It's kind of like a cut and paste.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You can like literally cut out the plant icons once you kind of figure out your base map and whatnot. So
John in Appleton has something. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. Every year when I grow zucchinis, I get vine borers. Is there anything I can do to prevent those?
Any ideas on that one, Rachel?
I am not sure. I've got to say the pest part of it is not my forte. I think I took plant.
Can't help you out there, but maybe John, maybe somebody else will have some ideas about preventing borers in zucchini squash. So stay listening and we'll get somebody on. The number, by the way, is 800-642-1234 if you have a question or comment, or maybe you can help John out with his borers. 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address talk@wpr.org. Mona in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mona.
Hi, I have a weeping willow. It's like a dwarf weeping pussywillow tree that I planted last year. And I'm concerned that the rabbits are going to just chew the branches all the way up. And I'm wondering if using, I don't use pesticides and stuff. I've got cayenne pepper, and I did sort of a little perimeter around it a ways out. I don't know if it would hurt the tree if I sprayed it on, or if it leached into the ground. Would that be a problem for the tree?
That's a good question. I would give it a try. You could also just try fencing your tree. That would probably be my go-to, just to try first. And if you're concerned about the cayenne, you can also buy like an animal deterrent spray or like granules that you can shake around as well. And I have used those. There are organic options, and I use those in my yard, and they seem to work pretty well.
Yeah. All right. There you go, Mona. Thanks for calling. You mentioned, here we got an email from Lois. She mentions, wants to know how skilled a gardener she needs to be to take the self-paced online course that you have.
Oh, you don't need any skill whatsoever. So the online course is for designing your garden. So you don't need any skill. And I basically walk you through the exact steps that I use when I design someone's landscape.
Michael and Terry in Nelson, New Zealand, emailed from New Zealand to say they often struggle knowing where to start and end up planting with not much of a plan. It doesn't always have the best results a few years later. They are interested, they're in a process of clearing pest plant areas, area by area, and they're having a planting plan. Would that help us save later on? They've run into crowding problems with previous projects, and it's hard to cull the trees you planted a couple of years ago. Do you have any suggestions for working up a plan?
Yes, I would say you definitely need a plan. And that's probably one of the biggest things that are the biggest struggles that my clients have is, you know, they tried something and it didn't work. The plant spacing was wrong. And what do they do now? So plans are super important because they can save you all sorts of time and money and frustration. And what was the second part of that?
Suggestions for working up a plan.
Oh, yeah, suggestions for working up a plan. So I like to start by just looking at the big picture and figuring out, you know, what's going on in your site, where, if there are any views you want to block, where the water is flowing, how it's flowing. Just have a really good sense of your property overall, and then figure out what you want in your property and just start chunking it down from there. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And of course, if you're in a city situation, you got to think about the neighbors too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What are their trees and so forth? And what else do they have growing on their side?
What's on their side of the fence? Any bellflower?
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Summer in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. We'll go to you now. Hi, Summer.
Hi. I was wondering if there are any recommendations for fruit trees that can handle less sun. We don't have a lot of sun in our backyard, only our front yard.
Yeah, so the backyard is where Summer wants to put a fruit tree, and wondering what fruit trees might work best when you've got a shade, kind of shady area.
Yeah, I would definitely check out elderberries. They grow just fine in a shadier area. You could try quince trees as well. Currants, those are shrubs. So yeah. I'm moving into the shrubs, and viburnums, which are also shrubs, but they can get pretty big as well.
Yeah. Quince.
Oh, and another one, pawpaw trees.
Yeah. And how big do they get typically?
The pawpaws, they get pretty big, like I want to say 15 feet tall or so, maybe larger. Oh, and American persimmons. Those are quite large, maybe 25 to 35 feet in height, I believe. But that's another one.
And they'll take shade.
Yep, they'll take some shade.
And they'll be creating it.
Yeah, and they'll be creating more.
And you'll be getting some sour fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Summer, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Rachel Bolita, our guest today, founder of Daily Harvest Designs. She's an experienced landscape designer and permaculture consultant. Questions for her, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. I want to thank everybody who donated during our one-day member drive. Is it a one-day winter member drive? And a lot of support from people like Leonard in Kenosha, Camilla in Milwaukee, Dennis in Lake Delton. All kinds of people make our WPR essential service possible. If you missed the member drive, there's still time to join in. You can put your gift at WPR.org. You play a really important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected, and thank you very much for your partnership. As we visit with Rachel Bolita, who is founder of Daily Harvest Design, and taking a look at edible landscapes with her, and great to have you listening in. And you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Sharon in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I have probably about an 8-foot by 4-foot bed of lilies of the valley in my backyard that don't blossom at all anymore, and I'd really like to get rid of them and replace them with something else. I've tried a little digging, but I'm wondering if that's the best way to do it.
I would say yes. I would probably try to dig for the lily of the valley. That would be my recommendation.
Would you, another approach might be one you mentioned earlier with cardboard and so forth.
Yep, sheet mulching.
So what would you do there? Mow it down?
Yeah, you could mow it down and then just sheet mulch. And make sure to put like 4 to 6 inches or so of wood chips on top, because you really want to make sure that you're keeping the light out, so blocking all that light.
But put a layer of cardboard down first.
Oh, yes. Yep.
And then the wood chips on top.
Yep.
Or anything else that you might want to use, I suppose. You could probably use pretty much anything as long as it was thick enough.
Yeah, as long as it's thick enough. And that and make sure it's a natural material.
Yeah. All right. Sharon, there you go. A couple of either dig it out or cover it up. those are the two for Lily of the Valley. Linda in Appleton. Hi.
Hi, thanks for your call, for your program today. Enjoying it very much. I have a very mature emerald ash, and that is probably going to have to come down in the next few years. Huge. It's like 30 years old. And do you have any suggestions for replacement shade trees that are not messy?
Okay, so shade tree that would replace that ash and may not be messy and is not messy.
Are you wanting something edible?
No, not necessarily.
Okay. I don't know. You could go with the good old maple tree.
Maples would work well. And if you were doing an edible one, what would you do? Of course, that could create a mess, but some that wouldn't?
An edible one that wouldn't create a mess?
Yeah.
I don't know if it exists.
Well, there are some where the birds will get them before you even have a chance.
But. Yeah. I mean, like serviceberry, that would be one that, I mean, it's not going to be as large, but that could be an edible tree that wouldn't be too messy. The persimmon would be another edible one. Any of the walnuts. I know that some people really don't like black walnuts, but I love them because we tap them for the sap and make really delicious syrup. So that's another big shade tree, but that can be messy as well.
Yeah, and it can create problems for other plants.
Yep, exactly.
Linda, there you go. Thank you for calling. Christy in Reeseville, your turn. Hi, Christy.
Hi, yeah. I haven't started anything yet, and I want to get into some, like, blueberries or vegetables, like squashes and watermelons and stuff like that. And it's a blank slate, just grass right now.
Yeah. So how does Christy start?
Start small. So if you're brand new to gardening, I wouldn't go all out and convert your entire yard right away, because, you know, it's going to take some time to get used to sort of the gardening and edible landscape lifestyle, because although perennial food plants are less maintenance, you know, you still need to go out and harvest and figure out what to do with them. So there, I would say there is a decent learning curve. So start with some annual plants, start with some herbs this year. If you wanted, you could add a blueberry bush, or another alternative is honeyberries. And I really like honeyberries because they're easier to grow than blueberries. They're very early to fruit, like at the end of May or so, they're usually ripe.
Yeah, they're very good. And blueberries, you know, for the kind of soil we have, this basic soil, sometimes it's almost better, I think, to have, rather than having to amend the soil every year, to maybe put them in a planter.
Yep, yep.
Because then you can, it's a lot easier to amend the soil to the proper acidity that really makes the blueberries go great.
Yep.
But the honeyberries are a really good idea, and they seem to be have gained in popularity over the years.
Yeah, I think so too. And they're a really nice landscape plant. They're well behaved. They look nice. The branching pattern is really interesting. So they have a good, like, winter interest to them as well.
Yeah, yeah. Christy, there you go. Thank you. Jay and Franklin, we'll go to you. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
About the squash, if you take medicine bottles, and when the squash are just emerging from the seeds, or you can fold down the leaves, get a medicine bottle on the very root, because the moths seem to go at the bottom of the root or at the bottom of the stem, and that seems to work pretty darn good.
So for the vine borer that you were talking about, you need to put something to prevent the moths from, you know, getting in there.
The plant, they go at the, I heard this probably on your show years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Jay, thank you so much. Appreciate that call. I knew somebody'd call in. Jen in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi, Jen.
Hi. Yeah, I'm wondering, I live in town in Madison, and so I'm interested in creating a privacy screening or a hedgerow using some native shrubs and some edible species. And so I'm first wondering which species you would recommend to do that with, and then also what type of spacing I would need in order to get that density level.
Well, let's see, some good plants for a hedgerow. If you're not wanting it to be too tall, I would go with like elderberries and some hazelnuts. If you want some prickliness to it, you could add in some gooseberries. Let's see, some smaller fruit trees. So any of the dwarf fruit trees that you would like. And then if you want it to be really dense, I would just look at the mature width of the plant on the tag, and then plant a little bit closer than what you normally would. So if a plant is 10 feet wide, you would want to leave 5 feet of space on either side of the base of the plant, right? But if you want it to be more dense, you know, maybe you leave 4 feet of space instead.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Jen, there you go. Casey in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Casey.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. My wife and I have recently celebrated a wedding anniversary, and it was our wood gift, and we are also first-time homeowners. I've been hoping for a long time. I know that she wants to get into gardening and whatnot, and I thought a fun gift would be an apple tree, something, you know, we eat apples all the time. It's something that I think that we really use, but also it has that extra element of it fits the wood theme. And as I was doing a little bit of research, I also found out that in order to blossom or to give fruit, you actually have to have a second tree. And I thought, well, gosh, that's just too darn romantic. and all the more perfect for the whole theme that, you know, it's not just one, but to get two. And, you know, I thought that was a fun thing. I'm a very novice, you know, guy when it comes to all this. And I just was trying to get a sense of, in terms of good times of the year to plant, particularly. I'm not a Wisconsin native. My wife is. You know, good times of the year that I might plant. I know I'm not anticipating fruit within a few years or anything like that, but it was just something I wanted to start off on the right foot. And
sure,
you know, in terms of all those considerations.
And you're in Appleton.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. For fruit trees, I definitely like to plant them in the spring because that gives them a year, you know, a season to kind of get established. You could also plant in the fall, but if I have the choice, I definitely lean toward the spring.
And then in terms of apple trees, I mean, there are some dwarf trees that, you know, depending on how much space Casey's got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say think about what type of apple you like or what you would like to do with the apples. If you're going to eat them fresh, if you're going to bake with them or make sauce, and then start narrowing it down from there. And just double check that you get the two apple trees that are going to work well together for pollination. So you can ask at the nursery when you go to shop.
So you wouldn't necessarily have the same variety? You wouldn't have to have both the same variety? Sometimes you would.
Fruit trees, I would say no.
No? Okay.
Typically different, but it really depends, and I don't know all the details off the top of my head, because some plants, sometimes you do and sometimes you don't.
Casey, if you and your wife have different, let's see, if you like different apples, let's put it that way, different kinds of species of apples, it might be possible to have a couple of apples that are that will, you know, work okay together, mm-hmm. but you'll get two different fruits.
Yep. Or you could get a little crazy and get an apple tree that has several different varieties of fruit grafted onto it. So it's like a 3-in-1 apple tree. So if you get like 2 different 3-in-1 apple trees, you'll get 6 different types of apples.
Oh my gosh, you're blowing his mind now.
I know.
a couple of 2 3-in-1s. What do you think of that, Casey?
I think that you're the correct phrase was blowing my mind. Didn't know that was even a possibility.
There you go. You've got your opportunity there, Casey. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, 3-in-1s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to do that with the. It's a good solution for urban properties, actually, especially if you need to have 2 fruit trees for pollination and you don't have the space. Just pick something that you can have it a 2-in-1 or a 3-in-1.
Yeah. And so here you are with your business, Daily Harvest Designs. You'll meet in person with people, but you also offer video conferencing and even some video classes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So there's lots going on and a lot of different ways they can use your materials.
Yes, definitely. I try to just have a variety of different ways for people to get support because everyone's in a different spot with their garden.
And just to end it, Sharon in Dodgeville emailed, she successfully deterred squash vine borers by interplanting nasturtiums in the hills with her squash.
Ooh, and that's another nice edible plant as well.
And it
leaves
is.
Leaves and flowers, yeah.
It is indeed. Rachel, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. It's been fun.
Rachel Belita is the founder of Daily Harvest Design. She's a landscape designer and permaculture consultant. So great to have her with us today. I think in Garden Talk next week, we'll have Melinda Myers with us. And that'll be fun as well to talk with her. It's a great show for me to be able to do. I always enjoy hosting these shows. And a big thanks to all our people, our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins at the board today, but Lee Rayburn also takes part, of course. And our executive producer, I'm looking at through the window right now, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store right through the afternoon here on WPR News.